The Metropolitan Opera. Now, you might think, okay, what is this guy doing going from a Walmart crime to the Metropolitan Opera? Well, it announced yesterday that it was canceling plans to simulcast John Adams' The Death of Klinghoffer. It was going to simulcast it this fall to cinemas around the world. Well, why are they now canceling their plans of simulcasting their production? They're not canceling their production, by the way, of Death of Klinghoffer. Now, you might say, who in the world is Klinghoffer? Well, back in the days that the most vicious terrorist organization in the world was the Palestinian Liberation Organization, the PLO, and its various offshoots. It's called Fatah today. It's the Palestinian Authority. But for years, the PLO was Islam's most notorious terrorist organization. Their offshoot called Black September is the organization that murdered the Jewish athletes at the Munich Games. They murdered the American ambassador to the Sudan, I believe. They are responsible for the assassination of Robert Kennedy. Sirhan Sirhan was a PLO operative. They have the blood of thousands of Jewish civilians on their hands. Back in the day, the PLO hijacked a ship. Not just any ship, it was a cruise ship. You know, you want to go on a cruise and, you know, see part of the world, and this one was in the Mediterranean. It was called the Achille Lauro. They hijacked the cruise ship, and one of the Islamic terrorists, a lesser life form, a goon, went up to a American who happened to be Jewish by race, but American, in a wheelchair. Now, he was armed to the teeth. All of his hijackers were armed to the teeth. This disgusting piece of crap. I think I can say that. Aaron, when speaking about a murderer, went up to this man in a wheelchair, couldn't walk, and rolled him off into the ocean, off the side of the ship where he drowned. And the opera, The Death of Klinghoffer, doesn't mourn Klinghoffer's death. No. It celebrates the cause of the PLO. It tries to show the motives of the PLO in a noble way, that they were fighting for something worthwhile. What? To occupy somebody else's homeland? The right to be terrorists? The right to be savages? What? I mean, this notion that the Palestinians are a people and that they are oppressed by Israelis is a lie on all accounts. There's no such thing as a Palestinian people. Not even remotely. Hasn't been a Palestinian people since the Philistines were destroyed by the Assyrians 2,600 years ago. And there is absolutely no racial connection of any kind, nor political connection of any kind, between the old Philistines and those who call themselves Palestinians today. None. And there's no claim of those who call themselves Palestinians and on Israel. And yet, this opera sought to display the cause of this mythical people on a land that they, not the Jews, are occupying. The opera is considered one of Mr. Adams's masterpieces, I'm sure, by those in the elitist circles who haven't any capacity to express any moral conclusion. It depicts the 1985 hijacking of the cruise ship, the Achille Lauro, by members of the Palestinian Liberation Front, and the killing of a disabled Jewish-American passenger, Leon Klinghoffer. The work, which sought to give voice to, it says here, Palestinians and Israelis, and hijackers as well as victims, to give voice. Let's say that it was trying to present the voice of the Israelis. Well, the fact is that Klinghoffer wasn't an Israeli. And since when do we give voice to the victimizers? And there is no such thing as a Palestinian. To give voice to the hijackers. It attracted controversy since its 1991 premiere. Peter Gleb, the Mets general manager, said that he remained a champion of the works of Mr. Adams. Oh, of course, because Gleb, you don't have a moral fiber in your body. And he does not believe that the work is anti-Semitic. But he added that he was reacting to the concern among Jews that the live transmission to theaters around the world would be inappropriate at this time of rising anti-Semitism, particularly in Europe. End quote. Mr. Adams denounced the decision, scum that he is, and reacted to the criticism the opera has received. My opera accords great dignity to the memory of Leon and Marianne Klinghoffer, and it roundly condemns his brutal murder, Mr. Adams said in a statement. It acknowledges the dreams and the grievances, not only of Israel, but of the Palestinian people, you moron. There is no such thing as a Palestinian people, and their dreams are immaterial when they become murderers, and they have no grievances other than those they've imposed on themselves. When the Muslim Arabs living in Israel were integrated into the Israeli society, when Israel did for them what no Muslim country will do for a Jew, to make them equal shareholders, to have them be full participants in the society, able to own land, able to own businesses, taxed at the same rate, educated in the same schools, beneficiaries of the same health care, able to vote in all elections, treated the same in the same court system. When they were afforded greater liberty and status in Israel than they are in any Islamic country, or that any Islamic country treats Jews, and became the best educated, the wealthiest by, in terms of non-OPEC anyway, the freest Muslims in the world. The Muslims couldn't deal with the fact that no Islamic country could produce a standard of living for Muslims that compared with the standard of living that Israel was affording them. And so they decided that they would become terrorists and they would murder their benefactors. And they began to. Under that basis, they don't have a grievance. Under that basis, their dreams and aspirations are for naught. You know, Mr. Adams, you really ought to have done a little study before you pretended that there was such thing as a Palestinian people, before you pretended that they have grievances, before you tried to give credibility to their cause. Mr. Adams said that the cancellation of the simulcast was a deeply regrettable decision that goes beyond artistic freedom and ends up in promoting the same kind of intolerance that the opera's detractors claim to be preventing. No, sir. When you promote lies that inspire people to be terrorists, you do not have the freedom to express that. It is like yelling fire in a crowded theater. You don't. Just as I can condemn Islam, but tell people to do so using their words, not weapons. When you're inspiring terrorists, pal, they aren't going to use their words. They're going to use their weapons. Adams defends his opera, Death of Klinghoffer, as a vehicle to air the dreams and grievances not only of Israelis but of Palestinian people. But it is about a terrorist act by abductors and torturers of defenseless people who are not connected to those that they have chosen to torture, to abduct, and to murder in any way. After all, Leon Klinghoffer, a disabled American Jewish passenger who was pushed off the deck of the Achille Lauro cruise ship after it was hijacked by the Palestinian Liberation Front, was a non-combatant. He wasn't even an Israeli. He wasn't even ambulatory. Thus, we will be subject to, this is a letter, by the way, that last statement was a response letter written by a thoughtful individual. He went on to say, will we be subject to operas humanizing the Chechen Muslim terrorists who and presented a vehicle that will share their dreams and grievances as they murdered the children in the Beslan schools? When does Mr. Adams want to do a piece on them? The disappearance of three Jewish teenagers, one actually American, in the West Bank. Reuters calls it the occupied West Bank. It isn't occupied. It's part of Israel. It's always been part of Israel. Has rocked reconciliation between the Palestinian political factions and risk sinking a new unity government. Yeah, that's why. Because, you see, initially, the PLO, Fatah, on one side and Hamas on the other, both ran joint editorials using the World Cup trophy of the three hands raised in victory. But they removed the soccer ball and replaced it with the three teenage boys that had been kidnapped, calling it a great victory. And now that the PLO, Fatah, has been tongue-lashed by the Obama administration, saying, you know, that makes it really hard for us to force Israel to surrender their country to you when you celebrate kidnapping. And, yeah, we understand that the PLO didn't do this kidnapping. It was committed by Hamas. But still, it makes us look really bad that we're trying to get Israel to capitulate to you when you're celebrating in your state-controlled newspaper kidnapping. And yet, the other side of the equation is that when Abbas said, you know, this works against our interests, which is not even the truth. It's the kidnapping works against the Muslim interest in Israel, because it shows them for who they are, savages. The Hamas, which is now in this unity government with the PLO, has decided to tongue lash Abbas, saying that he is nothing but an Israeli dog. And that by saying that the kidnapping was inappropriate, that he was playing into the hands of the Israelis. You just shake your head and you say, you know, Hamas is that indoctrinated with Islam that because Muhammad engaged in kidnapping, Abbas says kidnapping is absolutely fine. Now, the last time that Israel engaged in kidnapping, in a kidnapping situation, they had a soldier that was kidnapped by Hamas. They traded over 1,000 Muslim criminals, Muslim terrorists for him. 1,000 to 1 was one of the most stupid things that Israel has ever done. Now, you might have heard me in several programs to say, yeah, you're a hypocrite because you endorse trading Boko Haram prisoners for the 300 captured girls. And yes, I did. One for one, I would trade them. I would trade them, absolutely, in that case. And after trading them, I would do everything in my power to obliterate Boko Haram, including obliterating the villages that are harboring them, because the women that embrace them are no better than the Boko Haram militants themselves. But in this case, I would do the same thing. I would trade three leaders of Hamas that are in have been detained. I don't think I would trade those in prison, but I would trade the Israelis have detained over 100 Hamas leaders. I'd keep them in detention and said, yeah, I'll trade three for three. You don't want to trade, then we will continue to ratchet up the heat. And if I was Israel, I wouldn't transfer any electricity. I wouldn't transfer any water. I wouldn't transfer any food. I wouldn't transfer any taxes. I would completely isolate them. I would do everything I could internationally to block any shipments of humanitarian aid. I would isolate them completely. And I would only trade three leaders that you have detained as you're trying to search for the kidnapped children. Not anyone from prison. That's what I would do. But this is a rift now between the PLO, the Palestinian Authority, if you will, and Hamas that has them at each other's throat. Both calling each other un-Islamic. Both saying that one is working against the other's interest. It appears that this merger between Hamas and the PLO is already fractured. Welcome back to Shattering Mist. This article from Reuters reads that Hamas would stand to gain among ordinary Palestinians if it owned up to the fact that it coordinated the kidnapping of the three boys, particularly in Gaza. And it says that its credibility in Gaza has waned slightly because of the growing economic hardship. You see, Gaza was once controlled by Israel. And while Israel was there, there were business opportunities. There were factories. There were farms. But the Muslims wanted the Jews gone. And so the United States forced Israel to give up its control and involvement in Gaza, and it withdrew. And now there is nothing, because the Muslims don't run factories. The Muslims don't manage farms. And so now there's nothing but a bunch of deadbeats waiting for a handout. But amongst those people, they would celebrate the fact that their government participated in a kidnapping of three innocent young boys. Quote, if Hamas stands up behind the operation, it will gain its popularity as a resistance movement. And the Palestinian Authority will lose out, said an expert in the region. The last time Hamas kidnapped an Israeli was in 2006 when it conscript soldier, Gilad Shalit, in a cross-border raid from Gaza. It eventually released him in 2011, 5 years later, in return for 1,027 Muslim prisoners. Yep, and they were welcomed home as heroes. America, of course, is trying to force Israel, had a conniption fit when Israel reneged on releasing more Muslim terrorists, all for opportunities to talk peace with the terrorists. We were talking yesterday about Paul Bremer, the scumbag of America in Iraq, and every lie that he promoted. There are two that I would like to continue to discuss today. One was that they defeated al-Qaeda. You see, in 2003, when America invaded Iraq, not only was there zero, I mean, literally no al-Qaeda presence, al-Qaeda and Saddam Hussein were archenemies. They were foes. And when America invaded Iraq, there were no Sunni terrorist organizations in Iraq. There was a Shia terrorist organization. It was called the Mahdi Mujahideen. But it wasn't active. So once America invaded Iraq, Sunni Muslims and Shia Muslims both formed terrorist organizations, and they both became very active. But they had absolutely nothing to do with al-Qaeda. And both organizations, one became active and the others were formed strictly to counter the American invasion. The Sunni organizations, one was called the Islamic Army in Iraq and the other was called Ansar al-Sunnah. Sunnah is the basis of Sunni. It is the speaks of the example of Muhammad. It is the basis of Sharia law. Ansar is friends and supporters of the example of Muhammad. And then the Islamic Army in Iraq. Neither were al-Qaeda. And those were the two forces that America faced. Both of these were notorious for their adherence to Salafism, which is the traditions, the words and deeds of Muhammad and his companions, the first Muslims. They were overtly jihadists. And they actually perpetrated jihad against all non-jihadist Muslims in Iraq. They were equally happy to kill any peaceful Muslim in Iraq as they were any American or coalition fighter in Iraq. At the time, there was no reference at all to al-Qaeda among them. You did get one leader eventually that wanted to apply an al-Qaeda brand to his offshoot of the Islamic Army in Iraq, and Ansar al-Sunnah. And Osama bin Laden at the time wrote him back and said, no, don't. I have nothing to do with you. I don't want any association with you. And on the other side, you had the Mahdi Mujahideen. That was the army, some 50,000 strong, that marched to the orders of the second most prominent Shiite cleric in Iraq, a Iranian, as it would transpire, Mokhtar Sadr. Those were the belligerents. No al-Qaeda amongst them, and both of those belligerents, one took up arms and the others were founded strictly to confront the American invasion. So this notion that Bremer talks about of defeating al-Qaeda in Iraq, it's not true. There was no al-Qaeda in Iraq, and there was no terrorist jihadists in Iraq prior to the American invasion, and both of them were conceived to thwart the American invasion. So if we had not invaded, there would have been no Islamic terrorists in Iraq to thwart. We created them. And then we fought them. But we never fought them under the name of Al-Qaeda. They have never been Al-Qaeda. Now, as it relates to the economy and him talking about how wonderful the economy was and how much prosperity they had brought to the Iraqis, what he didn't want to tell you was that Iraq had one time been among the most prosperous countries in the Middle East. As a matter of fact, in 1980, Iraq's GDP, gross domestic product, per capita, was higher, and his references were per capita, was higher than any other country in the region. The only country with a higher per capita income, gross domestic product, in the region were the little tiny fiefdoms where, you know, you have a handful of people and massive amounts of oil, like Qatar and Bahrain, and Israel, which actually makes things, grows things. It was $3,453 per capita in 1980. Has never approached that number again. But then the United States put sanctions on Iraq. And since most of the per capita income of Iraq is oil, we put sanctions on them in 1990. We invaded, broke the country, and imposed more and more sanctions on them. And then in 2003, we invaded again, breaking the country all over again and imposing more and more sanctions. And Iraq, which had been the most prosperous country in the region, became one of the most destitute. So if you talk about increasing profitability or prosperousness amongst a people per capita, and you compare it to what you destroyed, as opposed to what had been before you destroyed it, you can claim success, I guess. But to do so, you have to be extraordinarily evil. You have to be purposefully trying to beguile. Your hubris has to be beyond restraint. When you talk about the gains that were made simply because you lifted the sanctions that you had imposed. During the 1990s, Iraq's GDP per capita plummeted. And it hit a low of about 12% of what it had once been in 1997, of $455 per capita, down from $3,453 per capita. It rose again slightly in 2000, but then after the American invasion, dropped down again to $742. Now it finally, as of 2011, with all sanctions lifted on the exportation of Iraqi oil, it has risen to about where it was in 1980. But that's not adjusted for inflation. And unfortunately, inflation is extraordinary in Iraq. But to Paul Bremer's claim, in the first year that he was in control of the Iraqi, and he was only in control a year. You know, he was the grand potentate of Iraq for a year. In the year that he was in control, the economy of Iraq contracted, shrunk by 28%, according to Business Monitor International. It regained some of that the following year. But to call regaining what it had lost when it was at its all-time lowest ebb, an increase, is to take numbers out of context so that you can deliberately deceive. Between 2005 and 2011, the economy grew at 6.5% per year. but that was only because of the release of sanctions and the money didn't go to the people. Bassem Youssef, a professor of economics at Indiana State University, describes Iraq's economic growth in the last decade as anemic, given its weak starting point. You know, when you destroy a country, you take it down to 12% of what it had once been. Now, at that point, and you release all of the sanctions, you would think that you would see robust growth to get back at least to where they were once the sanctions were released, but that just did not occur. The economy is depressed. It is restricted. And even with the influx of American cash, of which there is no accountability, it didn't matter. It didn't trickle down. We'll be back in a moment. An Iraqi economic expert wrote, even though their GDP is going back up, it returned to the level it was at 35 years ago. Ever so briefly, it's now being destroyed again. But, you know, imagine that. It's only returning to what it was 35 years ago. But it doesn't seem to help the average Iraqi, because there's no ability to spend the money. Nothing to buy. In 2012, the Transparency International group classified Iraq's public sector corruption. This is what Bremer was taking credit for, of building this, you know, great government and this great success and great constitution that would have provided, you know, law-abiding opportunities. It says that Iraq's public sector corruption was the highest in the world. The country was ranked 169th out of 176 on the corruption index. Yeah, you should be so proud, Paul. Iraq has always been dependent on imports, according to Wikipedia, and its agriculture and industrial sectors, which were already small, stagnated even further under American control. And that has done nothing but to cripple every part of the Iraqi economy other than oil export. After a massive jump in unemployment from 1990 to 2004, Bremer left in 2004, massive jump, 28.1%, nearly a third of Iraqis unemployed. That's during Paul Bremer's tenure, when America was breaking Iraq. At its height over the last decade, the consumer price index has surpassed 50%. Some sources say as high as 76.5%. In 1 year alone, in 2006, yeah, that's the legacy of Paul Bremer. That's when he left. That's when he was standing up there and said, "We got him." Consumer price index, between 50 and 76% inflation. Uncontrollable spending. Mustafa Ahmed, a father of two from Baghdad, tells the truth. He says, this is reported in Wiki now, that everything is more expensive now. He says, I used to buy a sandwich for 500 Iraqi dinars. It now costs 5,000. I used to fill a car with gas with 6,000 Iraqi dinars. It now costs me 30,000. The World Bank says that over a quarter of Iraqis still live in abject poverty, and that the number reached a high in 2007 under the legacy of Paul Bremer. But he says that even though unemployment has fallen, the number of those who remain as considered impoverished remains the same. There is nothing that Paul Bremer said that was true. Everything he said was a lie. And it's bothersome because he represents the Bush administration and the failed policy in Iraq, a policy that Bremer is unable to acknowledge. We were wrong. We failed. We broke the country, and there is nothing that can be done to salvage Iraq based upon everything that we did, which was wrong. He's instead saying, oh, boy, we were right. What a wonderful success. No, that broken glass and spilled milk that you see, that's an illusion. No, oh, no. We had gold-plated metal containers for our milk, and it was the sweetest ever produced. Aren't we wonderful? No, you're not, Paul. You're a lying, incompetent, immoral scumbag. And the lives of many thousands of Americans are on your soul. They stain your soul and the squandering of $2 trillion U.S. dollars. America's prestige and honor. All lost because of you, Paul. Wear it. You are to blame. As is George W. Bush that orchestrated the invasion. There was nothing to gain then. There is nothing to gain now. And it's worse now than it was then. When Shatter and Myth continues after the break, we're going to continue to review Yahweh's testimony so that you would know what he has to tell us in his Torah. And we will continue to do that until we finally move forward and begin with line one, word one of Paul's letter to the Galatians. But by this review, you will be better prepared to compare what he has to say to God.